going on in the specific research areas of PI in the last year. We're under very strict instructions not to call them groups. and the reason for that is that the groups are, if they existed, would not be very clearly defined. So this is kind of an overview of the people doing quantum information research at PI, and I tried to illustrate the overlaps with people doing also other areas of research at PI. And as you can see, the collection of quantum information people has a lot of overlap with the quantum foundations people. That's been true from the very early days of PI. There's always been quite a lot of people in this intersection. Something that's developed over the past 3 years is that we now also have a lot of people in this quantum information condensed matter area. And in fact, pretty much everyone we have in condensed matter at the moment, you know, this minute, is in this overlap or basically in one of the other overlaps. But of course, that will be changing hopefully quite a lot over the next couple of years. And then we have, you know, a couple of people doing quantum gravity research and quantum information intersection. That's a little rarer, but it's something also that's been present from the early days of PI. We've always had at least a couple of people that are interested in this overlap. And the other thing is we have one of our former postdocs, Sarah Croke, just finished her PI postdoc and has started as a Psi Fellow. That's one of the tutors for the Psi program. So we have good interactions with the other areas of PI. I should also add that even at the level of these overlaps, the borders are not very well defined, pretty fuzzy. So there's people that you could argue should be in one of the other areas, and people who are not on this who maybe should be on it. And of course, I haven't included any students or DRCs or anything like that, simply because the slide is already pretty full. Okay. Anyway, this gives you an idea of kind of how we relate to the other research areas at PI. And so what I wanted to do with the main part of my time is to discuss two of the four papers that were presented in the report that you got. And those two I'll discuss in some detail. I mean, it's only 15 minutes for each paper. But you're welcome to ask questions about the other ones if you like. So the first one is a paper of my own with Sandy Irani of Riverside, UC Riverside. And this is on the paper is on the quantum and classical complexity of translation and variant tiling and Hamiltonian problems. So what is that? Well, the basic idea here is that we're looking at a problem that's very much an intersection of fundamental theoretical computer science, in particular complexity theory, and physics, and in particular the physics of spin systems. And the type of physics it relates to is the physics of spin glasses. So the idea of a spin glass is it's a spin system, so a system of particles where each particle has an internal degree of freedom, which might or might not be a literal spin. A spin glass has the property that at low temperatures, instead of cooling down to its ground state or some other, you know, basically well-defined state, it gets caught in local energy minima. And it can stay there for a long time before, you know, some big fluctuation will push it into a different local energy minima. And the relationship this has to computational complexity is that a lot of computationally hard problems have a similar structure. A lot of them are optimization problems, and you're trying to optimize some quantity, like the ground state energy. But most search algorithms that you'd use to try to find that optimum will instead get misled by answers that are locally optimal, but not globally optimal. Okay? And that's one of the main features that makes a lot of NP complete problems hard. And it's the same feature that makes a spin glass a spin glass. So the idea of studying computational complexity can give us insights into the physics of spin glasses, and vice versa, I guess. Okay, so the specific problem that I'm interested in, or the specific type of problem I'm interested in, is going to lie in a quantum complexity class called QMA.
Now, QMA is, roughly speaking, the quantum analog of the complexity class NP, which means that it's the complexity class of problems where it might be very hard to find the answer to the problem, in this case, the ground state energy or the ground state. But if somebody gives you the answer, like gives you the ground state, then you can check that relatively easily on a quantum computer. So the name QMA in particular comes from quantum Merlin Arthur, which has a little story attached to it. So there's two people. There's Merlin. Merlin is a very powerful wizard. He can solve any computational problem. Arthur, on the other hand, is a king. He's very powerful, but he's merely mortal. Or in this case, maybe slightly more than mortal, since he has a quantum computer. And Merlin is Arthur's advisor. Unfortunately, Arthur doesn't totally trust Merlin. So whenever Arthur gets a difficult computational problem, he's going to go ask Merlin, what is the answer to this problem? But he insists that Merlin be able to prove that the answer is correct. Okay? Actually, there's an asymmetry. If the answer to the question is yes, he insists that Merlin prove that it's correct. If it's no, then he doesn't insist that. So this problem of given a Hamiltonian H, the question of does it have a low ground state energy, say, is the energy below E or is it above E plus delta? So is it below E? That's a question that's in this class QMA. Because Merlin can say, yes, its ground state energy is below E, and here's a copy of the ground state. And then Arthur can take that ground state, stick it into his quantum computer, and measure the energy of that ground state. And then he'll see that, yes, indeed, that state does have energy less than E. Okay? On the other hand, you can see the asymmetry there. If the actual ground state energy is high, then Merlin has no way of proving that to Arthur, no obvious way anyway. Because if he presents a state with high energy, well, Arthur can verify that that state has high energy, but it doesn't mean there isn't another state that's the true ground state that has lower energy. Okay? So QMA, as I said, is kind of the quantum analog of NP, and as such, we think it's going to be a difficult problems in general. The most hardest problems in QMA are going to be too hard to solve even for a quantum computer. And in fact, we think they're probably even too hard to check on a quantum computer. We think that QMA is bigger than NP. Check on a classical computer, I should say. Okay, so what type of problems are we talking about specifically? Well, I'm interested in something called the K-local Hamiltonian problem. So K-local Hamiltonian means a Hamiltonian with terms that interact K particles at a time. So the Hamiltonian is a sum of K particle terms. And the first problem whose complexity was studied here is the five-local Hamiltonian problem. And Kitaev showed that the five-local Hamiltonian problem, so that's Hamiltonians with sum of five qubit terms, is QMA complete. Okay? And that means that if you could solve this five-local Hamiltonian problem, you could solve any problem in QMA. And as I said, we think that QMA is too hard to solve, even on a quantum computer. And therefore, that means that finding the ground state energy of five-local Hamiltonians is not something we expect to be able to do in general on a quantum computer. On the other hand, Giffre and people like him are very good at finding the ground state energy of some very specific systems. Certainly a lot of 1D systems seem to fall in this class, and even some 2D systems. And so that means that there's somewhere in between this place of, you know, these specific classes of 1D systems and this general five-local Hamiltonian problem, the problem goes from something that we can do on a classical computer to something that we can't do on a quantum computer. Okay? So one interesting question from the perspective of complexity theory is, where is that dividing line? That's also interesting from the standpoint, as I said, of studying spin glasses, because that might give you a hint under what conditions a spin glass can exist. So there were a series of results which said that, well, this five-local Hamiltonians, the five particle interactions, that's not very realistic. And moreover, those five qubits could be located anywhere. They don't have to be next to each other. So people looked at more and more realistic sets of Hamiltonians, all the way down to Hamiltonians in 1D. And we found that even in nearest neighbor interactions in one dimension, although in this case it's not with qubits anymore, the problem is still hard. It's QMA complete. Okay? And then the recent result, the paper that I'm talking about right now, we went even further. So these Hamiltonians are, again, not very physically realistic. They're in just 1D and nearest neighbor interactions, so that's good. But the actual terms that appear in them are just kind of crazy. They're designed very specifically to show that the problem is hard. And more than that, they vary from place to place in some structured but, you know, not totally regular manner. So what we did is we wanted to study the complexity of translationally invariant Hamiltonians. That's a type of system that you see a lot in physics, of course, translationally invariant Hamiltonians. And so it's natural to ask if those problems are still hard. That would be a natural place for it to become easy. People study working in this field, I don't think any of us really thought that it would be possible to even get a complexity theoretic result about translationally invariant systems, for a reason I'll say in a minute. But we did manage to, and we showed that these problems are also hard. Although it's, for a technical reason, it's a slightly different result to QMA X complete. And in both cases, though, hard here means that we expect that this problem, solving this problem, finding the ground state energy, would take a time that's exponential in the number of particles in the system, even on a quantum computer. Okay, so why didn't we think that it was going to be possible to get a result, a complexity theoretic result, for translationally invariant Hamiltonians? Well, in order to prove that a problem is hard for the class QMA, you have to do what's called a reduction. What you have to do is you have to take an arbitrary problem in QMA and convert it into an example of this QMA complete problem. Okay? And to do that, you need some way of encoding the problem in the Hamiltonian that you're creating. Right? And there's a lot of different problems you can describe using n bits of input. Unfortunately, if you have a translationally invariant Hamiltonian, there's not a lot of different problems you can describe using only n particles, right? Because you have just one Hamiltonian term that's repeated over and over again. And so the only parameter that's left over is the number of particles. So you have a lot more problems than you have space to describe the problem. Okay? And so that's why it seemed like there would not be any complexity theoretic result possible. But it turns out there is. And the solution is to use this one remaining variable, number of spins, to encode the state. But to do that, you need kind of an exponential blow-up. So you're encoding problems of size log n, but to solve them takes much longer. It takes exponential time, even to check. But this is exponential in log, so it's kind of back to polynomial again. So this is the technical thing that's not terribly important. But that's why we have to go to this complexity class QMAX instead of QMA. But morally, it's kind of the same result. It shows that the problem is hard, probably even for a quantum computer. Okay? So that's the first paper. So the other paper I wanted to talk about is by Hector Bombin, who's a postdoc at PI. And his paper is on topological order with a twist, icing anions from an abelian model. So the idea here is this falls into the general idea of topological quantum computation, which is uses the idea of topological order, a condensed matter idea. So the idea of topological order and topological quantum computation is that in some kind of exotic quantum systems, you can get what's called anions. So anions, of course, are particles with fractional statistics. The idea of that, or the part that's relevant for quantum computation, is that if you take two anions and you move one around another, you'll get something non-trivial happening to the state. If you have fermions, of course, if you switch the two of them, you'll get a phase of minus one. But if you move one around the other, nothing will happen. But if you have anions, you can get a phase that's non-trivial. Anions, we're pretty sure, appear in the quantum Hall effect. But most of the quantum Hall states are what's called abelian anions. So in that case, when you move one particle around each other, all you get is this phase, e to the I theta, where theta is some nth root of unity or multiple. And that's not very interesting from the point of view of quantum computation. To do quantum computation, what we want is something more. We want non-abelian anions. And it's possible those also appear in somewhat more exotic quantum Hall states. But that's not 100% certain yet. And the idea of non-abelian anions is that when you move one particle around another, instead of getting a phase, you instead do some unitary rotation on some internal Hilbert space of the system. Okay? And the hope there is that by choosing an appropriate non-abelian anion model and moving the particles around each other, you could then do unitaries that will perform an arbitrary quantum computation in the encoded Hilbert space of this system. So why would you want to do that? Well, the reason is that the unitary that you do only depends on the topology of how you move the particles around each other. So in particular, if you take this green particle and you move it around the yellow one, it doesn't matter if you move it around in a perfect circle or in some wiggly line. And even you can have quite large fluctuations around your ideal path, provided you don't change the topology of the braid that you do. And that's very nice because, of course, when we're building a quantum computer, we can't expect it to work exactly the way we want it to. And so the idea is that a topological quantum computer would have some kind of built-in fault tolerance against errors. So one particular model that Kitaev suggested for anions is actually an abelian model, but it's perhaps the simplest example we know of topological order. It's called the toric code. So the idea of the toric code, so in this version of it, we're going to have the qubits of the system are going to be arranged on the vertices of the checkerboard. And it's the toric code, usually it's just sitting on a torus, but you can have different versions that, depending on boundary conditions, will work on a surface or on some other manifold. And the Hamiltonian of the system is going to be a sum of terms, each of which looks like xz, xz around each square in the system, the black and the white squares. And the thing is that all of these terms commute. So the ground state of this system is going to be one that satisfies every one of these Hamiltonian terms. Okay? And you can, if you put this on a torus, this state has a degeneracy 4, the ground state. But we can also solve and find what the excited states of this system are. And the excited states, well, they can be identified by particle excitations like this. And so, for instance, if you do one phase flip on the ground state of this system, you'll get something with two particle excitations located at adjacent squares like this, or diagonally adjacent squares. And there are three kinds of excitations in the system. So one is the ones that you get by Z. Those we could call the electric excitations. That's what Kitaev did. One will be created by X operators, and those will be, say, the magnetic excitations. And then you'll also have dion excitations, which are one electric and one magnetic at adjacent sites. And these particles, it turns out, are anions, but they're abelian anions. Now, if you just look at say, the electric excitations, and you try to move one electric excitation around each other, it won't get any phase. But if you move one of the yellow ones, the magnetic excitation, around an electric excitation, then you'll get a phase of minus 1. So it really is an anion, but you always can only get a phase of plus 1 or minus 1. And that's why they're abelian anions. Okay? So this is a model that's very interesting from the point of view of storing quantum information for a long time, but it's no good for computation because you can't do any interesting gates by braiding the particles. There's other ways you can improve it to do computation, but Hector came up with one particular one that's very interesting. So what Hector suggested was that by instead of doing this on a very regular lattice, square lattice, instead, suppose you put a defect in the lattice. Well, if you do that, it turns out you can change the relationship between the electric and the magnetic excitations. And in particular, by as you can see from this defect, you can take an excitation that's sitting on a black square, and then as you move it around the defect, it changes into one that's on the white square. Okay? So you've kind of merged the electric and magnetic excitation into the same thing when you're sitting, when you're somewhere near this this lattice defect. And the effect of that is it changes the particle spectrum, and it changes the relationship of these particles to each other. And it turns out that when you have one of these defects around, the particles you have are now non-abelian anions. Okay? So you can actually do non-trivial gates by braiding these particles around each other in the vicinity of the defect. Okay, that's a very good thing. That's taking this very simple torque code model and turning it into something that actually gives us some non-trivial quantum gates. Unfortunately, this particular model is still not enough to give us a universal set of quantum gates, but it's a step in the right direction. It shows us how we can take relatively simple models and upgrade them using something that's, you know, occurs rather naturally, lattice defects, and gives us hope, at least, that we can make simpler non-abelian models that will give us universal quantum computation and have this fault-tolerant robustness built in. Okay, so those are the things I wanted to talk about. I have time for questions. And like I said, you can ask questions on the other papers or ones that even that I didn't mention that you've heard about from yet.
In this last model.
Yeah.
I was just a little confused in looking at this paper. The
okay.
sigma is the thing that is, creates the defect.
Sorry, the
sigma operator.
Okay.
It's the endpoint of the defect.
The sigma operator is the endpoint of the defect. Okay.
So if you have the one, the sigma and the E, that's the Asimov.
Right.
What problem is it if you have the one sigma the E and the N? What's that sigma?
I don't know. Sean, do you know? Hector's not here.
Well, the E and the M are now in the same sector.
Right.
So they're not distinct. So that really comes.
Right. So that's what happens in this model. But is there another model that has E and the M separate? You know?
And also has a twist?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
I mean, kind of the nature of the twist is that it converts the E into the M, so. But, I mean, is there, I don't know, there might be, there's a lot of constraints on anion models. You can't just write down any set of particles and relations that you like. Then, you know, they have to satisfy certain conditions to be self-consistent. So it may be that the model you're talking about just can't exist.
Well, let me ask the question another way. So if you have an abstract algebra that has this non-abelian anion thesis, then, and that comes with a model, then that gives you an idea about how to realize this in physical system.
Yes.
So what would I be thinking about in terms of realizing this model in the physical system?
Oh, well, this particular model is actually going the other way, where we have a specific kind of realization. We have a Hamiltonian.
Right.
And then we want to go from that to figure out what the anion model is that's associated with it.
Oh.
Going the other way, well, I mean, to a certain extent, you can do that. But it may be that finding the simplest model that has that kind of anions, that's not obvious at all how to do that.
Oh.
So if you start with a simple model and find an interesting anion system, then you've shortcutted that problem of trying to find a simple realization.
So,
and you are saying about how you would actually physically realize that.
Yeah. So is the statement correct that create an isomorph, let's say some atomic analog system, and then I allow it to have dynamical defects?
Okay.
Actually got all the ingredients I need to have this model?
No. So this model is more complicated than Ising models. It has four qubit interactions. So people have talked about how to realize this physically using various kinds of, basically, you know, kind of almost quantum computers that can simulate all sorts of interactions. So when I say this is a simple model, that's true, but it's not a model that appears naturally in any system that we know. As far as I know, the only kind of real big candidate of naturally existing anions is in the quantum Hall systems. There's maybe some other things that people talk about, but that's the one where it's really been pinned down. But there might be others out there that we just haven't discovered yet.
Or we might be able to manufacture them in some way that's easier than building a big quantum computer. Yeah?
So in thinking about one-dimensional translationally invariant quantum models, I mean, people attack those with classical computers all the time.
Yeah.
Using DMRG and other
techniques.
And particularly in the cases where the spectrum is gapped, they more or less find exact ground states. And,
right.
And so I'm just a little surprised that those models form the most complicated class. Of
Some
intuition why that is.
It is a pretty surprising thing. So I can say that these are not gap systems. So they're gapless in the asymptotic limit. Another thing that is a subtle but important technical thing is that it depends a lot on what precision you want to get. So in this case, we're demanding an energy precision that's polynomial, that's 1 over a polynomial in the number of particles.
So if you use DMRG, you're throwing away the information you need to reach that precision.
Yes, basically. So systems that are gapped, that have spectral gap, I don't think we know. Those are definitely not going to be QMA hard. They're at most NP hard, and probably they're not even that. But we don't know for general one-dimensional systems whether they can be simulated efficiently. Certainly, there's lots that can be. That's definitely the case. But we don't know in general. For systems that are not gapped, but where you only insist upon kind of a constant energy, I don't think we have any clear idea. Energy precision. I don't think we have a clear idea of what the complexity of that. Maybe Gifre has an opinion. No.
Are these local models?
These are nearest neighbor interactions, but they tend to be... they tend to be highly frustrated, but even that is not quite true. What they are is very high dimensional. Each particle is very high dimensional. In 1D, that may be necessary. In 2D, I suspect it's not. In 2D, I suspect actually this type of behavior is fairly generic, even in relatively small, with relatively small particles.
Yeah. And following up from that, you did mention at one point that even though problems might not look hard, you invent weird and wonderful interactions to make them hard. This is what you're hinting at now, I suspect.
Yeah. So,
give me an example.
So for this specific problem that we came up with, I said the goal here is to move towards, you know, some system that people actually care about and showing that's hard. We have not done that yet, but translation invariance at least makes it kind of plausible that one could get there. So the systems that we came up with, I did kind of a back of the envelope calculation. We didn't bother to figure it out in detail, because it depends on some, you know, universal quantum Turing machine construction. But my rough estimate is that for this translational invariant Hamiltonian, to prove that it's hard, we need systems where the particles have an internal Hilbert space of dimension like 1,000. Sorry, dimension like 2 to 1,000. Okay, so it's pretty complicated, but we didn't really make much effort to shrink that, because, you know, if it only went down to 2 to 100, it's still crazy and unrealistic. But in two dimensions, I really think that it'll be very simple. My feeling is that kind of the classical analog of this is already getting hard when you have like 4 or 5 states per particle, and probably the bottom one is hard, maybe even for a qubit, it's been a half particle. But I have no idea how to show that.
So, paraphrase what you said. I mean, you said you wanted to show that the problems of current interesting in that moment are hard, but
right.
What you really want to show they're easy.
Right. Well, okay. So it depends. It depends who you are. I've only done work. So it comes on both sides. Okay. I've only done work on the hardness side. So that's, of course, my thing is to show that they're hard, the goal. But remember, showing that they're hard gives you a good hint that this would be a spin glass. So I think finding a translationally invariant spin glass, which is already kind of an unusual thing, with very simple interactions, I think that would be very interesting. Now, on the other hand, showing that they're easy, that would be great too, because that means that you can simulate them and find lots of properties about them. One thing that's an interesting possibility is somewhere in between, which is finding a problem that's hard for a classical computer, but easy on a quantum computer. And we don't actually have, for this ground state problem, finding the ground state entry, we don't have a good example of such a system, actually. Quantum computers are very good at finding the dynamics of quantum systems. But the ground state, I don't know. I mean, you kind of expect that they should be better than classical computers, but we don't have any good examples of that. Okay? Are there questions?
About this last point you just made.
Okay.
So consider a two-dimensional Eisenmodel on a triangular lattice with anti-ferromagnetic interactions. So that's an exactly solved, it's an integrable problem, so it's not a spin lattice. But if you made an analogous construction in higher dimensions, you would expect that to be a translational invariant spin lattice. I'm probably way out of my depth here, so maybe you should give
okay, me a I will pass it off to someone who has a better.
No, I mean, most spin glasses are not translationally invariant systems.
Right.
I mean, you can have sometimes constrained dynamics in models, which can have very, because of that, they're very slow dynamics. But these fully frustrated.
The question we're talking about is some kind of fully frustrated.
So the fully frustrated spin models.
That's a very complex ground system.
I mean, they often order, through disorder, they find some way of ordering that they can fluctuate along into a disordered region.
So Daniel's using spin glass in a different, different term.
So
talking about essentially the entropy of the ground state rather than the order disorder.
What I'm talking about, the things that I've been talking about, what I can prove is that it's computationally hard. Okay? And that's related to being a spin glass, but it's not the same thing. It's probably the case that you can have systems, and the other thing is that all of this is at zero temperature, so the whole spin glass thing is a little fuzzy then anyway. But these systems, I think, would be good candidates to be spin glasses. That's maybe the best thing.
What
I can
you
say.
Mean is it won't relax the equilibrium? That's what you mean.
That's right.
The ground state.
That's right.
You cool it to zero.
That's right. That's right. But it's certainly possible to have a spin glass that's not computationally hard. And it's probably possible to have something that at any finite temperature is not a spin glass, despite being computationally hard. But they're related.
Any other questions?
Probably it's allowed for non-SAC members to ask questions too.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, okay.
Let's move on to the next. So that's fun.